Welcome to EIR Talks. On May 1, 2002, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche Jr. held an international webcast on the possibility of peace in the Middle East before a live audience in Washington, D.C. This week we bring you the conclusion of his opening remarks along with a series of questions from the worldwide audience.
Should we also be aware of something else? How many Americans know this is going on? How many American parents know their teenage and younger children are addicts of Pokemon or Nintendo games or similar games which produce the same effect? What's their attitude about it? What's their attitude about Harry Potter, this British production, which induces people to believe in that they can solve problems by exerting arbitrary magical powers to bring about the destruction of people who offend them? What about the Tolkien cult? Of the Lord of the Rings cult, which is a milder form of the same thing. How many parents know this? You have people talking about pornography on television. Well, that's something. But what about this? Mass killing and training your child to kill you, you know? You get two kids sitting out there in the room saying, let's go ahead and burn mommy and daddy tonight. This is the kind of culture you're creating. And thus, this kind of culture then reflects itself in what? It reflects itself in our military policy overseas, which is insane. Now let's look at this, what happened in the Middle East. Let's start with Warsaw. Warsaw, 1943. Let's see what Sharon is actually doing. Look what we're up against. This is the title page of a report, which is produced by a Nazi general of police, Jürgen Stroop. Jürgen Stroop was assigned by the Nazis, by Himmler, to go into Warsaw and clean up something which in 1943 the Germans, Nazis, wanted to clean up. Remember, the Nazis had taken those Jews they hadn't killed otherwise in Poland, and they herded a great number of them as cheap labor into Warsaw, in a Warsaw ghetto. As a matter of fact, the Jews in the Warsaw ghetto were often chiefly occupied in producing things for the German military. In the Warsaw ghetto, some people in the Warsaw ghetto decided to resist. And with a few carbines and pistols and ingenuity, they staged an effective resistance. At that point, the Nazis said, how do we clean this thing out? And Stroop came up with a policy for eradicating the Warsaw Ghetto, Jewish Warsaw Ghetto, and killing all the inmates immediately or sending them off to camps where they died soon after. Then he sent a message to Hitler. The Warsaw Ghetto is no more. And he published this report. Now, here's what you're looking at. These are the typical kinds of scenes from that picture. Being marched out of the ghetto to death camps. Typical, the lineup. Just keep going. Another scene from that same place, same time. This is the Stroop report. Now let's look at Palestine today. What's the difference? It has the same purpose, is to get rid, is to call the settlements policy, or the Eretz Israel policy of the Likud, which is the fascist movement in Israel. Then it was to make Warsaw Judenfrei, free of Jews. Now it's to make the West Bank free of Arabs, of Palestinians. So a few people resist from among the Palestinians. The tanks march in. The killing goes on. There's no difference. Moreover, as Haaretz reported, the way in which this operation was designed, which was done under Sharon's direction, designed by the Israeli Defense Forces Command, was modeled on a study of the Stroop report, to study the problem which the Nazis faced in dealing with the Warsaw Ghetto, and to say, we have the same kind of problem here in Israel today. We're going to clean them out. The same kind of process. When the President of the United States refers to Sharon as a man of peace, I'm sure that Sharon feels insulted. But the point is, why then was the United States support this? It's not because there's a Zionist lobby. As a matter of fact, you have some of the worst anti-Semites in the United States are the so-called pro-Armageddon Christian fundamentalists. They're anti-Semitic. Anyone who comes from the southern part of the United States knows that. These are the real anti-Semites in the United States. These are the real Nazis. They think like fascists anyway. Do you think these guys like Jews? No, they don't. They don't care about Jews. They don't care about that. What they care about is their policy. They're saying, look, if you can get the rapture next week, I don't have to pay my rent next month. I mean, it's that bad. So this we have created a society of madmen in these so-called thunder cults, these thunder religious cults inside the United States. They're crazy, psychotic, in effect, not in the real world. They have become a significant political force behind people like Pat Robertson in Virginia, for example. They're dangerous. And this is the constituency of hate, the Ku Klux Klan constituency. They hate, have to have somebody to hate, somebody to kill. And they say, them Arabs, look like black people to me. They do, don't they? Look, I'm an old man. I've been around this country for a long time. I know what goes on in this country. I was training troops in the army back during World War II. I know what was sweeping in from southern parts of some parts of the United States. I know what they said. I had to deal with them. That rot is deep in our country, and it's come forth, and it's used as a weapon. The purpose is to do what they're doing. Do you think these Nintendo games are some accident that crept up on us because of Hollywood? Yeah, Hollywood is doing it, doing that kind of thing. No, this was done by the U.S. military. It was done intentionally to do what? To create among our youth stone killers who can be recruited to be sent in various parts of the world and do there exactly what the Israelis are doing there. No, it is not the Israelis who control the Zionist lobby, who control the United States. It is an Anglo-American faction of this type which has an instrument inside Israel called the right-wing Likud, typified by Netanyahu, who is more dangerous than Sharon is. These guys are the killers who are doing the work of the Anglo-American Roman Legion mentality in the Middle East. What do these guys want? Well, Israel cannot continue this operation. It will lose Israel if it continues this operation for military reasons, which are well understood in some circles in Israel. As a matter of fact, Rabin, the former prime minister, understood this very clearly. Israel cannot continue to do the kind of thing that Sharon represents and Netanyahu represents and survive. How then can Israel survive? Well, they really don't care. There's a Masada complex among some of these nuts. They'd rather go over the cliff than be defeated. But the key thing is Iraq. The key purpose behind this operation is to use this to get a wider war going, to get the Clash of Civilizations war that Sam Huntington, Brzezinski and company want. So what you have here is a combination. The training and recruiting of large numbers of otherwise useless youth, psychotic youth, or quasi-psychotic youth, by Nintendo games designed by the U.S. military, put into general circulation through the military with cooperation of Japan's production of Nintendo games and so forth. We are now taking from our population, our youth, our adolescent and other youth, we're turning a large portion of them into potential intended killers, who are trained killers, trained on their video games, who then simply have to go out and get trained with actual weapons and do what they've been trained to do on video games. Recruit them as soldiers and send them in various parts of the world as part of a Clash of Civilizations war. Put the two things together and you have the new Roman legions, the new Waffen SS, to send around the world. So what we are suffering, our corruption, is a result of our policy, which many people in our country in high places know, but they haven't got the guts to say. And therefore we come to the position that I have to say it, because there's nobody else. You know, you can go into almost any significant circle in Europe or the United States, you drop my name in a meeting and you're going to have a freak out. The place is going to go wild. Just say the name LaRouche. The whole place will go wild. So actually, that my impact inside the United States and also in Europe and those places is rather large, but especially so in the United States. So when I speak, people listen. They may not like it, but they listen. So I use the voice I have and the influence I have to try to force people to face the truth about the situation. Now, how is peace possible? Implicitly, it should be obvious. We have the power in the United States, and Europe is prepared to join the United States in such an effort. I can assure you, most of Europe, Italy, most of Germany, so forth, are willing to support the United States in such an effort. To say that we are going to bring an economic basis for durability of peace in the Middle East, that we're going to do what was proposed earlier, two states, equally sovereign, side by side, living together in peace. Why? Because first of all, you've got to provide the water that they can all have something to drink, something to live. And there isn't enough water. Some of the big impetus for war in the Middle East comes from a shortage of the water in the aquifers. We're capable of generating large-scale, efficient desalination programs, which can produce water economically for drinking and other human purposes. We can overcome the water crisis of the Middle East. The Middle East is, because of its position as a point of traffic of Africa to Eurasia, is a crucial point of transport from the Mediterranean into the Indian Ocean. It's an ideal place for the development of industries which are on the line of transportation. Where you could take the Sinai, you could take whole parts of the Middle East, and you could develop them as areas of industrial and related development, very relevant to the relationship not only to Africa in general, but the relationship of Europe as a producer of high technology goods into areas of Asia which desperately need infusions of high technology goods. So there is no basis in either the interest of the people involved or in the interest of Europe or the United States or Asia to have this war go on. The purpose of justified war was to produce peace, was to bring about a state in which the person you fought against would accept you to live with you in peace because they saw the reason to do so, because you gave them a reason to do so. The purpose of war is not to kill, not justified war. The purpose is to bring about peace in the quickest possible way with the most people. You want to bring about peace? We have the power to bring about peace in the Middle East, because we have not only the capability ourselves, but we have friends in Europe and elsewhere who would enthusiastically join with us in any program of reconstruction of the entire Middle East region. Now, we don't have much as a president of the United States, but the man is president. And therefore, why don't we work on the problem of trying to create around him an environment where it is communicated to him that the United States does have an interest. He may not fully understand it, but make it clear to him what that interest is. The way it was clear, in a sense, to Eisenhower. The way it was clear to Johnson in terms of the civil rights legislation. That something has to be done because it's in the interest of the United States. Tell him not to be afraid of the so-called Zionist lobby in the United States. We'll take care of that for him. Do the job. And give him some good advisors. So that you say to him, why do you motivate a guy like George Bush? There's only one way to reach a fellow with his limitations. And that is to say, you've got a job here. It's an important job. He says, yes, it is an important job. Well, do you want to be a success? Yes. Do you want to be remembered in future generations as having been a great president? Yes. Okay. You agree to that, we'll make you one. And that's what we have to do. Thank you.
I have a statement here from a prominent Roman Catholic official, which also asks Mr. LaRouche for a comment. The person writes, We continue to be in a terrible time in the Middle East. This can be exemplified by the Calvary of Bethlehem, the siege of the Church of the Nativity. We are in constant touch with Archbishop Pietro Sambi, the Papal Nuncio in Israel, who is also the apostolic delegate to Jerusalem and to Palestine. The Pope is informed constantly and is most concerned. On Sunday, the Holy Father asked those who came to St. Peter's Square for a chorus of uninterrupted prayer for peace in the Holy Land. He seeks to affirm, he said, the initiatives of distension and dialogue in the land of Christ and in every other place on the planet marked by violence and pain. Today, the Pope dispatched Cardinal Roger Echegaray to Jerusalem to try to effect a change in the situation by employing all the weight of the moral authority and international credibility of the Catholic Church for peace. The situation is very cloudy. John Paul II prays that there will be cooperation with his papal envoy to end the siege and the 24-hour-a-day curfew. The people in the cities and surrounding refugee camps are desperate. They cannot stand it much longer. They are sick and starving. The elderly are dying. The collective punishment is simply unacceptable. The place where the baby Jesus was born is a horrible example of this. Life there, at the Church of the Nativity, has been called by the Franciscans trapped inside a slow death. The vocation of their order is to keep this place holy, but the Basilica has been under siege since April 2nd, when Palestinians took sanctuary in this holy place, as churches for centuries have been places of sanctuary. 27 Palestinians were allowed to leave the church yesterday, but the friars do not see this as progress. Since about 40 Franciscan and Greek and Armenian Orthodox friars, monks, and sisters, and about 200 Palestinians are still inside the church. They have hardly any food or water or electricity or medical supplies, and they stay with the dead bodies of those who have been shot by the Israelis still inside. Special forces of the Israeli YAMAM have been used against this holy place. The General Curia of the Friars Minor today expresses its bitter disbelief at the incapacity of the civilized world to induce the parties to accept and carry out a greatly longed-for Pacific solution. Their words are borne out by the experience of Khaled Jerassi, a Palestinian civilian who was released only to be beaten by Israeli troops as they questioned him last night. The man had already lost 33 pounds during the standoff at the church because the supplies of food are so very low. The Church of the Nativity is one Calvary. Ramallah, Jenin, and other places of sorrow are under siege. We pray for cooperation between the Palestinians and Israelis, of course, who must concentrate all efforts to find a peaceful solution. But the Israelis are the ones who must withdraw and end their siege. The few Christians who inhabit the Holy Land are wondering, what are the other 2 billion Christians in the world thinking? What are they doing? Mr. LaRouche, would you please comment on this?
First of all, when you look at the Nativity Church, what you're looking at, think in terms of another place, Al-Haram al-Sharif, the Holy Mountain. Remember that when Sharon started his last campaign for prime minister, he unleashed an attempted assault on one of the holy places of Islam on the top of this mountain in Jerusalem. That this issue of this particular location was a crucial breaking point in the attempt to get a Camp David agreement, where Barak, under pressure of this crowd, the Likud crowd, remember, he used to work for Sharon, Barak did, in the Israeli military, that was a breaking point. This issue of this particular holy site, Al-Haram al-Sharif, this is what is on the mind of the butchers who are going at the Church of the Nativity. Because remember that one of the conditions for Middle East peace, for avoiding a clash of civilizations war, for avoiding a 30 years war scenario, is that the holy sites, those of Islam, various confessions of Christianity and Judaism, are sacred. They are sanctuaries, that nobody can tamper with them. The condition of religious peace is a policy of sanctuary, which means that in whatever agreement is reached, the sites of the holy places must be assured to be, of being able to function and be intact. And whatever governments exist, they must respect that law. Without that, there is no peace. Anyone who attacks this, the Church of the Nativity, in this way, which is not really an issue, there's no reason for that to be, it's not a military issue, it's not a police issue, means that they want religious war. Now, the thing to put the pressure on, that's obvious to everybody in the area. It's obvious to people in Rome. What's wrong with the American Catholic Church? Why is the American Catholic Church allowed itself to be shut up under intimidation of an orchestrated scandal against Cardinal Law in Boston, who would normally be the person speaking out on this issue on behalf of the American Catholics? Why are the American Protestant churches not speaking out on this thing? Because they're afraid of some of their Protestants of the Bush variety, of the Attorney General of the United States, perhaps, in his particular religious persuasion? Why is no one speaking out in the United States? Where's this pack of cowards called Christians in the United States? They call them the Cowardly Lions, not the Christians. What are we doing? Have we looked at the Catholic bishop in the eye and said, what are you doing about this? Have we looked at Christian figures in the eye and said, what are you doing about this? Do you believe in religious war? Because that's what you're promoting if you don't do something about this. At least if you don't take a stand against it. If you don't put moral condemnation on it. If you don't say anybody who says they're for peace and tolerates this kind of thing is a hypocrite or worse. You know, sometimes we can't do much. Sometimes we can only make an appeal to conscience. And that is particularly true of the religious profession. Often you have no authority, you have no power, you can't do anything. Actually, you can't command, you can't write laws, you can't give orders in that sense. But at least you can appeal to conscience. And if you don't appeal to conscience, what are you? You're nothing. And this is where the pressure has to go. It has to go on the American Catholic bishops and others not to submit to a dirty operation run by the people who targeted Cardinal Law in Boston at this particular time, when he would have been the normal channel through which to issue a condemnation of what's being done against the Church of the Nativity. Realizing that what is being condoned is not merely an insolence against that church. What is being condoned is a denial of the existence of the policy of sanctuary. And if you deny the issue of policy of sanctuary, if you make holy religious sites battlegrounds of religious warfare, you are going to have global religious warfare. And you won't have much left standing in any part of the world if you start that kind of a war.
We have a question that was submitted in writing by a former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton. His question is the following. He says, Mr. LaRouche, beginning in about 1998, there was a grouping within the administration that agreed with aspects of what you said and was moving in a serious effort with the support of the president for a new financial architecture. Bluntly, things were too heavily stacked against it. The conditions now are far worse than they were then. Whether these policies are right or wrong seems to be irrelevant unless there is adequate support for a move in the direction of a new financial architecture. I'd like you to address this issue.
That's a good question. It's a relevant question. Well, the point is what's politics, real politics like? You know, people in the United States are brainwashed about popular opinion. They're brainwashed by the use of the word democracy. Now, I hate the word democracy. You know why I hate the word democracy? Because I remember the name of the organization, a fascist-like organization, which tried and executed or condemned to death Socrates. That was called the Democratic Party of Greece, translated into modern English. And there are people in the United States who say they're for democracy who represent exactly that policy. It's the policy of mob opinion. Now let's go back and another definition of the same term democracy, according to the practice of today. Roman vox populi, popular opinion. Another word for democracy is a Southern Ku Klux Klan lynching. Popular opinion. You see, what the problem here is with our people in the United States, I'll try to make this short, but it's a crucial question. Because it's a question of principle. It's not a question of technique or tactics. Question of principle. The basis ever since Plato, ever since Socrates, and since Solon, actually, earlier before Socrates, Solon of Athens, the famous poem he wrote to the Athenians, warning them of how corrupt they were becoming and what was going to happen to them for their corruption, is the principle of truth. See, the point is the purpose of government, of self-government, is to force, to bring about expression of truth and to appeal to the conscience of those who rule that they must conform to the truth. Now, we don't even have that in the federal courts today. It's hard to get a judge to accept truth, particularly if there's got a Justice Department liar up there dictating the policy. We have gone away from the idea of truth to popular opinion, which is what happened in Rome, which is how Rome was destroyed by its own citizens, sitting there voting for popular opinion, not for truth. So therefore, what we must always do, the first thing we have to fight for, is the principle of truth. Now let's take this case of these guys who oppose me on economic policy. You have to tell them what they really are. They're corrupt.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll resume in a moment with a continuation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 1st, 2002. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 1st, 2002.
Look, why do the trade unionist leaders often take an insane, immoral policy on economic questions? Because they were bought off by the illusion of 401ks. That is, the special savings programs. Now, the 401ks are being wiped out. But this then was a lure to trap unions into giving up their defense of their pensions, their Social Security and other pensions. They would get riches in 401k. And then came Enron. And what happened to their pensions? Corruption. You have people, African Americans today, who should be fighting, are not fighting. Why? Because somebody told them they should fight for reparations, not for their rights. Don't demand freedom. Get some money from the master and walk away, slave, but with a few things jingling in your pocket. That's how the African American, who is an important force in U.S. politics, is being destroyed today because of issues like local issues or special issues like reparations. He's corrupted by reparations. Martin Luther King was, in the killing of Martin Luther King, was one of the smartest things that J. Edgar Hoover ever did with the U.S. military. Why? Because King was effective and none of the people who were standing after he was killed were capable of taking his place. Why? Because Martin Luther King believed in the truth. And Martin Luther King spoke for principle, not for advantage. He did not appeal to the lowest instincts of people. Freedom. Freedom for all. To make the entire United States whole by purging it of the evil which was destroying it, including racism within it. And the people who came afterward were opportunists, who responded to the opportunistic impulses of the people they were leading. They didn't lead the people, they tried to follow them, to follow their cupidity to wherever it led. And that's how they lost their power. That's what happened to civil rights. It had no leader, no acknowledged spokesman who'd stand up for truth, for principle, but said, we're going to get this deal, and then we'll get that deal next week, and that deal next week. And you say, well, we got to go against you, no, because we got a little interest here. And that's how the American people are constantly destroyed. That's how they've been destroyed in many cultures. They go for little things, for deals, for short-term interests. They don't understand that if you're a human being and you know you're going to die, everybody dies. But human beings are different. Because human beings have a quality which lives on beyond them. And therefore, if you are human and know it, your motive is not what you get in terms of what's jingles in your pocket. Or like Jeanne d'Arc. Jeanne d'Arc did not play for her personal advantages. If she had, France would never have come into existence. Others who died, the principle of Christianity, the same thing. Christ died for all mankind. If you don't have that and are not willing to stand for the truth on the basis that you must not die with a lie on your shoulders, that you must know the truth, you must act for it, then you have a problem. Now let's go with the lies. There's a lie called denial. People all over the United States today are saying, no, but there's a recovery. Some people say there's a recovery. The statistics say there's a recovery. This is going up, that's going up, that's going up. How about your jobs? What happens if the valuation on the shack, which you just cashed out on, collapses and you lose your job? What's going to happen in Northern Virginia when the cash out runs out, for example? So people are in a state of denying. They're saying, because I wish to believe it can't happen, it couldn't happen, I believe it. And you attack me and say there's a depression going on or about to come on, you are attacking my right to have denial. And everybody tells me that if I'm shown to believe in this recovery, which is not occurring, it's like Dracula's denizens gathering dust, waiting for the recovery, which he keeps promising them. Somebody's going to attack me. My neighbors aren't going to like me. My children will scold me. They'll say I'm nuts because everybody knows there's a recovery, but there is no recovery. So on the economic question in particular, people are in a state of denial. Also, they have other states of denial. The mental conditioning of the population in general is to believe in a consumer society. Think of it carefully. How many aspects of the life of the citizen in Europe, the United States, or elsewhere believe in things like consumer society? How many people believe globalization is good? How many people believe free trade is good? Other kinds of insanity. Therefore, if you attack the present economic system, which is collapsing around their ears, the house is collapsing, they say you are attacking our values. And our neighbors won't like us if we attack our values. Therefore, they are defending an illusion. No civilization was ever destroyed by itself, except by its popular beliefs of these types. If people continue to believe this, they're going to be destroyed. Now, how do you get people to stop being stupid, as most people are, leading people and others in the United States today? Well, unfortunately, that's one of the reasons that history has this cyclical characteristic. Is every people that makes mistakes of this type or reach the point that the nation is doomed, like Shakespeare's Hamlet. Hamlet was not, Shakespeare's Denmark was not doomed by Hamlet as a bad leader. Hamlet was doomed by the fact that he was a leader consistent with the culture of the nation he represented. George Bush will not destroy the United States. The United States could be destroyed. It'll be destroyed by its own people. What are the two clowns we voted for presidential candidates in the last presidential election? You voted for two people who are not qualified to be president in face of the worst crisis in American history. The American people did that. We did it to ourselves. The lesson of classical Greek tragedy, the lessons of Shakespeare's tragedy, the lessons of Schiller's tragedy, of every great writer and historian, is that a nation is never destroyed, unless conquered from the outside, is never destroyed by itself, except by its own popular opinion, by its stubborn clinging to wrong opinions which bring about its own self-destruction. We, as the United States, are on the road to self-destruction, not by outside enemies. The enemy within is more powerful and more dangerous than any possible enemy from without. The enemy is us, it's the people. Now, when that point comes, the only way that a people whose enemy is themselves are ever likely to get out of that habit is when they reach the point of death. Not actual physical death as such, but the point that the inevitable hits them. For example, in the case of the civil rights movement. Now, all these fellows who told you about the great civil rights record they have back in the 1960s and 1950s were liars. Where were they when the fight was going on? They were carefully avoiding getting out in the parades with Martin and company. They came in later when the glory started. Initially, the people who marched, who fought for civil rights, in the struggle for civil rights in the late 50s and early 1960s, were the have-nots. Because here you are, people, men and women, who were destitute, who came out and marched peacefully, but stubbornly, against fascist mobs, because they knew that their life meant nothing in the eyes of the system. And if they're going to do something, they're going to risk their life only for that which is good. Because all the other things have been taken away from them. Therefore, it is at the site of the collapse, when your mortgage is being foreclosed, when there's no hope of employment, not that, when you can't see it there, when the danger of war, when the chaos, when the destruction of your children by Nintendo games and so forth, when this gets to you, that you realize that what you've been living with is an illusion, and you're willing to change. This happened, look, I had the advantage of living in the 1920s, and being old enough at that time to see the constitution of the population around me. They stunk. Morally, they stunk. They all stunk. Now, they had some good qualities inside them, but morally, in their general behavior, they stunk. My parents, like everybody else, lied all the time. They called it company manners. And similarly, you're told to do what you say what you're told to do, and when you get old enough, you can think for yourself. So you were conditioned not to believe in the truth. You saw the flapper age. You saw the corruption, immense corruption of the population prior to 1929. Now, two things changed it. It's not that Franklin Roosevelt was a great leader. He was. He was a great leader because he was the one who was available at the time who was willing to move in the right direction and had a position to do it. But the reason people were moved behind Roosevelt was because the illusion had been shattered. And if you know people as I knew them then, between, say, 1928 and 1934-35, and saw the changes in the American population, you'll tell you exactly what the problem is. The problem is this people in general and the leaders of it are corrupt. See, why I do what I do is this. The problem with the American people is they don't have enough people like me. Yeah, not people who necessarily express things exactly the way I do or my profession, but people who will say, look, the situation is going to become hopeless. It is becoming hopeless. What should we do? Well, you say you have to have some power. You say, how do you get power? Well, everybody will agree you get power by support of the people. But how are the people going to support you if they disagree with you? Because you persistently unite to tell the truth. And the people, because you're telling them the truth, and because a lot of people they think are leading people are telling them the truth, are going to take it seriously. And they're going to think about the false values which they've had, what they need to change in their own opinions. That's how a movement is made. The problem I have in leading people is there's not enough of me. If I could get more people who are in leading positions to be willing to tell the truth, first of all, to discover what it is, with the determination to tell it whatever it is, we could change this. And that's why I do what I do. Somebody has to stand up and tell the truth. And on these matters, I'm the only significant voice internationally on this range of issues as an American spokesman who is telling the truth. If I could find 10 other people who are recognized leading figures in the United States to join me in telling the truth, we could change this country. They'd kill us all immediately, or we'd change the country.
We are so glad that Mr. LaRouche does what he does. I have a question for Mr. LaRouche from Russia, from Professor Menshikov, whose name is familiar here in Washington, D.C. He spent many years here as an adjunct of the Russian embassy, and he knows the United States quite well. Professor Menshikov has also shared the podium with Mr. LaRouche on numerous occasions. His question today is the following. He says, Mr. LaRouche, what is your view of the U.S.-Russian negotiations on strategic weapons? In Russia, some experts think that it is a unilateral disarmament of Russia. Do you think that this is true? And should Russia actually sign this treaty?
Well, the answer is that this is one of the things that makes me think kindly of President Reagan. Reagan is a complex man who I met personally on one occasion. We had a chat of not great consequence, but it was a very useful chat, which turned out to be useful in later months. We were sitting at a presidential candidate's event up in Concord, New Hampshire, and he and I were arranged at the table with the other presidential candidates in alphabetical order, so I was next to Reagan, who was on the corner. So we chatted for a while these proceedings were going on. And because of that and because of other things, we met in the period following the election with people of his. And other forces in the military and so forth were also had interest in some things I had. So I presented to the incoming Reagan administration in the transition team, to various people in it, including Richard Richards' crowd and so forth, presented what my agenda for the United States was. Just as a matter of anybody, a new president's coming in, anybody of influence who's invited to do so will be very happy to go into any new administration and present to relevant people in that administration or incoming administration what their agenda is. So as a result of the discussions which followed from that, we the president showed interest in several things I proposed, including one. And I insisted that it was feasible through the use of so-called new physical principles to devise an approach to the missile crisis. And I insisted that we were headed under counter policies, the policies of Brzezinski and Schlesinger, as we were, which I knew from 1975 on. We were headed toward a potential for that nuclear war because of the policies of Brzezinski on the Carter administration crowd. I don't think Carter had the brains to know what it was, but Brzezinski knew, and Brzezinski controlled Carter from the beginning. That we could avoid that if we could get the Soviet Union to agree to work together with the intent of getting us out of this thermonuclear missile confrontation. And that the Soviet system had a weakness in it, which we could help fix if they would cooperate with us. The Soviets had a very capable military scientific complex, but the rest of their economy stunk. And it stunk because they believed in popular opinion. That was their problems. And therefore, the administration, they didn't understand what the entrepreneur was. They believed in the objective forces of history. They didn't understand the voluntarist principle in history, which is the role of the successful, good entrepreneur, whether it's a farmer, as an industrialist, or a scientist. And therefore, we could help fix that by showing them how to turn some of their military-industrial capabilities into a basis for entrepreneurial endeavor, and that by developing certain technologies which would enable us to ultimately prevent a nuclear missile assault from working, that we could accomplish something for third world countries and others, which would be a common interest in avoiding war, and a common interest in building a basis on this planet for justice for humanity in general, by going directly saying our constituency is that we're working for it, we're going to benefit finally what were the former colonial regions, the so-called developing region. And we're going to use the new technologies to help them do that. We need these in order to be able to stop the nuclear missile attack. We can do that, not so quickly, but we engage in that process. So he came around to like the idea. And I worked on it considerably with governments abroad, people in governments abroad in Germany and France and Argentina, India, Italy, and so forth. And so the point came that he decided one time that I negotiated this also to a back channel, which was authorized by the Reagan administration with the Soviet government. And he came to the point that he decided it was a good idea. And then, as I found out only the same day, on March 23rd of 1983, on a five-minute segment at the end of his broadcast, he announced the proposal as a proffer to the Soviet government. The Soviet government turned it down. Now, today we have a different situation. I'm not in the U.S. government, number one. I'm not even considered persona grata with the present U.S. administration. So therefore, and there's not many of the people, scientists and others with whom I worked back in the 1970s and early 1980s, in any of these countries, which is capable of doing today what I proposed then. People do not realize the extent to which we've lost scientific competence. We do not have the human bodies with the brains in them of the type that I was working with among professional military and scientific circles back in the 1970s and early 1980s. They don't exist. They died. And they have not been replaced. And our institutions generally are not capable of replacing them. So the idea that someone is going to produce a super anti-missile system or something of that sort, this space-based NMD, so on, that is not possible. And the government of Russia knows it's not possible technologically because the competence does not exist in the United States or Russia to do it at this time. Impossible. What is being done is, as usual, is fakery. There is no sincere intent on the part of the people who are putting this on the teleprompter for Bush to read. What he understands, I don't know. But I know he doesn't understand any of this. Right? Are serious and sincere about what they're offering. It is purely manipulation. The way they think is this. And you've got to look at several things going on. I look at China, Russia, and India. Obviously, China has a different way of looking at the world generally than Russia does or than we do in the United States as Americans. Although they tend to look at things in a much longer term basis. They think in terms of what's going to happen 20 years from now or two generations from now. They think of China as a permanent institution surrounded by an outside world. They have relations with it, but they think of China as China. And they have also in different internal currents within China, different cultural currents within China, historically determined cultural currents. And therefore, they're very reluctant to make any commitment to any kind of the kinds of policies that we in the United States used to make or Western Europe. They think differently. They think of waiting the game out, of China's survival, of making agreements that they can live with, maybe live with for 10 to 20 years, and then maybe later if a change is necessary be made. But now what's happened is with this crisis, China and its economic crisis is now in a position where it has to regard the WTO as one of the worst catastrophes and mistakes it ever made. Because the Chinese economy is suffering greatly internally as a result of not just WTO, but things which Chinese opinion tends to associate with WTO. China is now relying largely upon its internal market, that is the infrastructure investments and technology as a source of growth, not exports to the United States, an import of last resort that doesn't exist anymore. So China is now faced with what it realizes is a very serious threat from a bunch of madmen in the United States. This is an immediate threat. It's not something to be faced 20 years down the line, but now. But China has no capability of conducting a war against the United States and won't for 20 years to come, if those things are now. So China is not a strategic military threat to the United States. But the United States, like a bunch of fools, is trying to provoke China with a Taiwan adventure. They're insane. Absolutely insane. So China provoked. It cannot respond militarily. It has no inclination to do so. But then you have a very powerful coalition which is developing in Asia. And you see the marches of Chinese representatives to India. And what was deprecated by many people back in 1988 when I was pushing it, and then Primakov pushed it, the idea of strategic triangle. The strategic triangle is now on board. Russia is involved with it, though Russia is also playing a game with Putin, with the United States, and so forth and so on. But the Chinese reaction is going to tend to be, is there a global alliance? And they will first of all think about the United Nations as a global alliance, and try to get done what they can to the United Nations on these problems. They will try to find a partnership and cooperation among other nations and try to bring pressure to bear to prevent the ugly threat to all civilization, which they recognize now as what's going on in Central Asia and the Middle East and elsewhere. They see the world collapse of economy. Look, China and Russia and India are the three principal sources of exports of Western Europe. China and Russia are the two areas that are increasing exports from Germany. The economy of all Western Europe depends upon, continental Europe in particular, depends upon the German economy. And the Chinese see this. The Chinese have taken German technology. They took the magnetic levitation railroad system. They took from Germany the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. They're taking other technologies from Western Europe. Their existence depends upon it. So they see a global threat. Not a direct threat from the United States, they see that too, but they see a global threat to civilization in general from which China cannot escape in terms of these developments of U.S. policy now. So I think that Russia is aware of this, obviously. Putin is certainly aware of this, and people around him, who some of them are experts in this area and therefore understand this very well. Therefore, Russia is in a very difficult situation. It is not thinking about making a war against the United States. It is being confronted with on the one side, the offer of friendship or partnership or whatever. On the other side, threat after threat after threat. Little threats, big threats, all kinds of threats. Putin has his own internal problems. So you have a situation where Russia does not have a clear unilateral alternative for the kind of problems that Russia faces. I don't know if Putin can think through this by himself. because he also has other problems to deal with in Russia, those left behind by George Bush with the International Republican Institute, for example, things like that. So I don't think Putin has a clear view. I see no signs of what I would regard as a clear view of the situation. He probably has, as others in Russia do, a clear sense of some aspects of this problem, particularly some of the military implications. But I'm not sure they see them clearly, because to understand a problem clearly, you sometimes have to see the solution first, then you recognize the problem. It's when you find the answer to the question that you understand the question, and really never fully understand it until you do. I think that's the problem. But I would say this whole hokum about these missile agreement, these negotiations, has now broken down into a total farce. But the behind the farce, for me, is the fact that it was never serious to begin with. And I made a serious proposal and design back in the end of the 1970s, and Reagan adopted it and presented it. We could have, if Secretary Andropov had not said no, if the negotiations had proceeded the way we were starting with the back channel discussion, you would not have the mess in the world we had today. We missed a terrible opportunity. And that occasion of Reagan making that offer to Russia was the last really serious offer ever made to Russia about anything. And that is why I think that Reagan deserves to be listed as perhaps the last actually sitting president who at least one moment had a sense of vital American interest.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 1st, 2002. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.